Hello, and welcome to episode 209 of The Ethical Life, a weekly podcast that explores the intersection of ethics and modern life. I'm Scott Rada, a digital strategist with Lee Enterprises, and I'm joined, as always, by Rick Kite, who is head of the Ethics Institute at Viterbo University in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Hello, Rick.
Hi, Scott.
Work isn't just about projects and deadlines. It's about relationships. How we connect with the people we work alongside can shape whether a workplace feels supported and meaningful or cold and transactional. At the same time, technology, remote work, and shifting cultural norms are changing how those relationships are built. So, Rick, let's start our conversation here. Why do you think workplace relationships matter so much to people's sense of meaning and well-being?
Boy, there's so many answers to that question, Scott. So,
well, you got 45 minutes.
We've got 45 minutes. So let me start. So the first 10 minutes. because relationships matter so much to our sense of well-being, there's nothing that matters so much to our potential for happiness as the quality of our relationships. And because we spend so much time at work, a large percentage of our waking hours, most of our really productive hours are spent in the workplace. So workplace relationships have always mattered. They matter more now because we spend so much less time than previous generations socializing outside of work. So much more time is spent at home consuming digital media, either individually or with a spouse or with just some very close friends or family members. And so workplaces have increasingly become the primary place where people form friendships outside of their private life.
In preparing for today's show, you encouraged me, and of course, whenever you encourage me to do something, Rick, every time I do it, every time.
Yeah, except bothering people who are in your bike lane. I encourage you to do that, and you don't listen.
But you encouraged me to listen to a recent podcast by Scott Galloway, and he had on a guest. She's a psychotherapist and best-selling author named Esther Perel. I think I'm pronouncing that right. And she's really kind of shaped a career around how technology and culture really can strengthen and sometimes harm these connections. And one thing she talked about in that show, and I'd be curious for your feedback on this, is she really identified four pillars of strong workplace relationships. And the four she picked out were trust, belonging, recognition, and collective resilience. I'm curious, you listen to this podcast, do you agree with those four? And if so, why?
I agree with them, and they're largely consistent with all kinds of studies that I've been following. I've been teaching a course now for 20 years on building community, where we're looked at how do you build good relationships and strong teams, mainly in the workplace. The main one is trust, and that's what she begins with. You can't build trust unless you're with people that you like and respect and know something about their personal lives. Like you have to know something beyond simply what you do as far as your work-related tasks together. Mm-hmm. Because eventually you're going to run into some kinds of conflict with your work-related stuff. And you have to go a little bit deeper. Like, what reason do you have to like and respect this person? And the more you know about somebody, the more likely you're able to build that trust relationship. And so all these things, like she talks about belonging, like that is really significant. I'll just mention, one of the reasons belonging in the workplace is becoming more significant is because people increasingly don't have a sense of belonging outside of work. And so then if you're outside of the home, where are you going to feel connected with other people? Well, it better be in the workplace, because if you haven't got it there, you're going to feel kind of rootless.
And, you know, both those things, and I guess you could even tie it to recognition as well. I sort of, as you were talking about those, had a thought is, we'll just say belonging, right? You could, in the workplace, I could kind of think of that in two ways. One, belonging to like your team and feeling like your colleagues value you, feel like there's some camaraderie there, you know, that you're all sort of working on these projects together and kind of lean on each other's points of expertise. And then there's also sort of another kind of belonging, it seems, where the company makes you feel like you're a part of its much larger mission, not just your little team's corner of the operation, but much larger mission and just the way they treat people from, you know, from the onboarding process when you're first hired, kind of through all the policies and procedures that are in place that sort of set the rules for those workplaces. Those are kind of separate. And I could imagine there are times where some people listening might say, yeah, I feel really connected to my colleagues, but I don't really feel that connection with the company I work for. And I suppose it's even tougher, right? If you're working for maybe an ice cream shop and the owner's with you all the time, yeah, it's probably pretty easy. But if you work for some multinational company that has 25,000 employees scattered across the country, I mean, that's tougher, right?
It's a lot tougher, and different companies have more or less success in creating a sense of connection, both with small, relatively small number of people that you're working directly with, and with the larger organization. And that's usually because you have some kind of identification with the mission of the organization or the very purpose of the work that you're trying to achieve collectively. And it's hard to say what's been happening. What we know is that many young people come into the workplace expecting to be motivated in some sense by the purpose of the work that they're doing. They expect to find their work being meaningful and to kind of invest in it emotionally. Is that being driven by their expectation, or is it because many companies are just finding out that this is the way you get much more productivity out of people, is that you create very high levels of engagement? One of the ways in which you do that is you create identification with the mission. And so you have a very strong articulation of the mission and the values of the company you work with. A lot of companies talk about doing this. Some do it really successfully, right? And others don't. But I think both things are going on. I think because there's so many really successful companies that have figured out how to do this well, that has driven the expectations for many young people going to the workplace that, yeah, that's the kind of place I want to work for.
You'd said a couple minutes ago that you've been teaching classes on this for, what, 20-some years?
Yeah.
And it makes me wonder that our workplaces are in some ways quite different than they were 20 years ago. I think it was extremely rare 20 years ago to have someone work from home. But still, there are a number of people who have hybrid roles, spend some time at home, some time in the office. So there's that. But are there other changes you've seen in the past 20 years as you talk to people and people talk to you about these issues that you see both good and bad?
25 years ago, I was hired to be the first director of the Reinhardt Institute for Ethics and Leadership. And I eventually started teaching this class on building community as kind of, in some ways, an extension of that, a program we started in servant leadership. That all came about in response to what had happened with Enron and WorldCom and a lot of other companies that had, like significant companies that had been involved in huge ethical scandals, ethical and financial scandals.
And they just simply broke the law in many cases.
They broke the law. They deceived people.
Yes.
They treated people horribly. They ended up either firing a lot of people, but they were lying to their employees and they were lying to their investors. It just came down to that. And there was really a national concern, like, how do we fix that? How do we make our companies pay more attention to their ethical responsibilities and also like just their financial responsibilities? And part of that was regulatory changes, but the other part was a cultural shift. And I think that in the United States, we've been largely successful at navigating that cultural shift. For example, before I came here, I remember I was teaching in another place in a school of business where I was teaching a course on business ethics. I remember a faculty member in the classroom next to me telling a student that ethics has nothing at all to do with business.
Huh. Right?
That was a pretty widely held view. It's not very widely held anymore. A lot of people say, yeah, of course ethics matters to business for a number of reasons. For one, you want to prevent things like Enron, right?
And, I mean, there's also a connection between well-run workplaces with happy employees and making money.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it just makes it makes good practical sense to have a business that's operating legally, and if you're an ethical organization, you're largely going to have happier, more engaged, more productive employees. So it makes sense for a lot of reasons. So I think there's been a huge cultural shift. The bad is this: the world has also shifted in ways that we've been talking about quite a bit, as far as the ways in which we don't have nearly as much experience with how to develop social connections. And every generation spends more time alone, and every generation coming up has less experience on how to deal with conflict and how to build kind of trusting, successful relationships, whether that's intimate relationships and also successful professional relationships. So that means at the same time that companies know it's more and more important to create environments where there's really good trust and the ability to collaborate and work well together, the people coming in have less experience in how to do that. And so that's the good and the bad.
And we mentioned a few minutes ago on this podcast, Esther Perel, who's sort of an expert in this area. There was also a piece I read, and we'll share this in the show notes, where she was featured in a Time magazine article. And she's created this deck of questions or a deck of cards, and each one has a question that is intended in some ways to, I guess, do what you say a lot of people maybe aren't good at, is start these conversations. And these, I think, can often be used with people who work remotely, because it is hard to get to know people just through a little box on the computer. But I think they work in person, too. And like some of the questions in this card set are, what brings out the best in you? Or when did you last feel truly acknowledged by a colleague? And the point of these, of course, is to kind of spur these conversations and these discussions that give you a little insight into someone and make you kind of figure out what maybe motivates them at times. I have my own thoughts about this, but I mean, do you think things like, and again, she's not the only person who's created sort of these icebreaker sort of things, but do you think they're useful? And have you ever tried doing things like that in your classes, or advised employers to do that in their workplaces?
To the latter couple questions, absolutely. Yeah. And I've used over the years a variety of different exercises when I do workshops to just build relationships among the people attending.
Mm-hmm.
But and I do this in classrooms as well. And part of the purpose of doing these exercises in the classrooms is to give people experience at how do you do this. So when you go and you're working with your own team of people, what do you do? And what I find is more and more people need some real practical tips, not just being told that it's important to do this sort of thing, to get off of the agenda, so to speak, mm-hmm. and pay attention to the fact that the agenda is always in the room. Like there's always things on people's minds that you have to bring out. And the question is, how do you bring them out? Because if you have discontent, or you have concerns, or people have questions or worries that they're not expressing, and you're bringing teams together, but you're not allowing them an opportunity to express them, those problems, those unvoiced questions or concerns or worries are going to surface in ways that are counterproductive. Now, you can't always just ask directly, like especially when you're the boss and you've got a bunch of people who report to you, and you can't just start out by saying, okay, what concerns do you have about the way I'm leading this team? Right? Like that's not going to go anywhere. And so you find indirect ways of getting people, you know, the confidence of speaking freely, and part of that is being vulnerable yourself. So you kind of demonstrate that you don't mind criticism. You don't mind revealing some things about yourselves. But you just get people comfortable with one another and trusting one another. And then those unvoiced concerns can come up. And so, like, the questions that Esther Perel has given in this card deck are just a number of ways of indirectly and slowly, incrementally building up the kinds of relationships that allow the genuine but unvoiced concerns to come up so they don't sabotage your work relationships.
And I certainly agree with the parts where you say that whether it's at work, and we're talking about mostly workplace issues today, but whether it's work or outside of work, that people are not as comfortable in social settings as they once were. And I think finding ways to increase that and make people more comfortable is a good thing. I just see exercises like this of, you know, having this card deck and randomly pulling out a card and then saying, well, Rick, tell me what brings out the best in you. And then we'll all go around the room and share. Just seems like so forced. And it seems like, to me, it's saying, well, we have absolutely no other way to build relationships naturally, so we're going to bring in this blunt instrument. I'm skeptical whether it would work on me, but maybe that's just because of my personality type. In your experience, I mean, I think you've even talked on the show about where in your classes at your university, you'll often start off asking students, maybe not a question like that, but just sort of a conversation starter, right? And do you get the sense that those work? And do you get the sense that people realize, maybe this is the way to phrase it, do you get the sense that people realize the reason you're doing that, what your intent is? Or do they think you're just, oh, here's Rick just trying to, you know, well, start a conversation? Or do you think, well, here's Rick trying to draw out people's feelings and concerns in a kind of blunt way?
Yeah, so I think there's wrong ways to go about this. So say you go on Esther Perel's website and you order the deck of cards,
yeah,
because HR has suggested that this, yeah, is a good thing that all team leaders do. And so you announce to your team, okay, before we get it down to our real business, we're going to take 10 minutes and we have to, everybody has to answer this question.
Yeah,
yeah, it's not going to work.
And see, that's kind of what I'm picturing. So how do you see it working well?
How do I see it working well? Well, here's what I'll do in a classroom. And I'll just say, you know, like it's really important for, we're going to be talking about controversial issues. And we're going to talk about things that are tough, that we're going to disagree about. So it's going to be important for us to get to know one another. And I usually also say something like this. It's important to start with something good at the very beginning of our meeting together, because when you start out with something positive, you tend to get more focus on what's positive as we go along. And so I'll just usually start out, like the very first class is I'll ask people to go around the room and say, just tell me about something good in your life. Very general, very broad. It can be kind of trivial. It could be something quite significant. But then they get used to every week when you start the class, or you know, it'll be something like, what is something that you're grateful for? What's something that's made you happy? Tell me about something you witnessed this week that made you happy. And people will just tell about an encounter at the grocery store or at the gas station, something like
that.
Or
it could be that their grandmother got some, you know, great diagnosis that she's going to live another 25 years.
Yeah. And in some of those, sometimes you'll get stories that are quite profound.
Yeah.
Right. And first of all, you participate in it yourself. You don't say you're doing this because you have to do it.
Yeah.
You're doing it because you want to get to know people, and also you want to focus on something positive, because everybody knows we're going to have a whole bunch of difficult things. Like if you're in a typical workplace, you've got all kinds of challenges and you're going to try to work through them. But let's start out by focusing on something positive. And generally, people really enjoy sharing something good about their own life, and they enjoy hearing about something good in other people's lives.
One thing that came up in the show, and I just wanted to kind of get your take on, was because you're right that people are spending less time with other people, and people that if you're in a workplace setting, you're going to just be kind of pushed to meet people whether you want to or not. And some of those people you may not like, some of those people you become friends with. And of course, there are plenty of times where those work relationships become romantic relationships. And as I think someone said, that, you know, that is something that like every HR manager and legal department just says, I just wish that would never happen in our company. And I think we all understand. And if you don't know, there's a Coldplay clip out there you can go back and watch where there's like the wrong way for that to happen. If you're at a very high level in your company or and, you know, you have a lot of people reporting to you and those things we all know are not good. But if you're just like two people on the team of people and you're peers to each other on the organizational flowchart, I mean, do you think workplaces should be wary of these romantic entanglements developing? And I guess to me, it just seems like only a natural thing. And yeah, you're going to have, like anytime you have romantic relationships, you're going to have things that go badly, but you also have things that turn out really good. And I'm just curious if you think that should be such the red flag that it is for so many employers.
I have mixed thoughts about it. I think that many employers spend too much time focusing on the red flags and trying to prevent the red flags. And so what they do is they make policies for the exception and not for the rule.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, in the past, many employers have not just discouraged romantic relationships at work, they've discouraged friendship at work, or, you know, any kind of like socializing outside of the workplace among fellow employees. And that's really bad, because for the most part, friendships among people at work is one of the surest ways to increase engagement.
And I would imagine to increase retention.
Absolutely. I mean, if you have two or three good friends at work, you're very likely to want to stay there, both be happy there and to want to stay there. If you don't have any friends at work, it makes it really easy to leave. And so we know this. We know this from all kinds of studies. And so there's gradually been a shift. But the reason many employers for a long time discourage just routine friendships at work was because sometimes it goes sour. And sometimes, you know, like people are close friends and there can be enmity among or jealousy among other teammates or favoritism. There's these things that can happen. But all of that is not nearly as bad as not having anybody know or like one another.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? So there's paying too much to the exceptional bad things that could happen. And I think the same thing happens sometimes with the concern about romantic relationships, that of course there's whenever you have people socializing in the workplace, you're going to have romantic relationships develop. What you need to do is figure out, like, well, what are the rules and the boundaries? And there has to be certain kinds of boundaries, like between somebody who supervises or there's a power unequal power relationship. Yeah, that should be discouraged. And mm-hmm. But it's fairly easy, I think, to have an understanding of what's allowable and what's not. And then there has to be some sort of gray area where there's a need for judgment in some cases. And you can't have policies about everything, right? I mean, this is one of the things that about life is you can't anticipate so much of what will happen in life in ways that you can have policies that like ensure that only we have only good outcomes and prevent all the bad ones.
Well, and that's kind of leads me to maybe the last point I wanted to touch on before we close here, is that one undeniable trend that we've had in most of our workplaces is that we have become more and more reliable on we rely more and more on technology to do our jobs. And no matter what kind of job you have, if you're working with computers, not that they're always perfect, but there you pretty much know what to expect, right? And even with AI, which we have this whole new world, we're still like in control of these things, at least right now. And when we're, you know, working with a spreadsheet, as unexciting as that might sound to some people, we still know how those work, and there's rules behind them. And you said in the workplace, HR can't create a policy for everything. Well, on a spreadsheet, there is like a policy for everything, yeah. right? I mean, yeah. every cell has a purpose, and there's formulas and all sorts of things that, and I think there's a theory there that says because we are more and more connected to these computers or in our personal lives to these devices where we push a button and we know what happens and these services will feed us information that kind of matches what we like to see and engage with. And then we have like people. And unlike these devices, people are not always predictable, oftentimes not. And we don't always know what may happen when we talk to them. And we may actually, Rick, have to have a difficult conversation with somebody sometimes. And do you agree with the general premise here I'm getting at, that as we become better and more fluent in the tech world, we have sort of lost our capacity in many ways to connect with people and maybe avoid people because they aren't predictable?
Yeah, and there's some really interesting neuroscience on this too, and how the brains work as predicting engines. Like we're always presented with a number of like possible outcomes of all the things that we're doing, and this is how we make choices. The more we engage with technology, it takes a lot of the unpredictability of life away, and so there's less anxiety. But what that means is whenever we're dealing with people who are inherently unpredictable, because we're not controlling or manipulating them.
You shouldn't be predictable.
You shouldn't be, yeah, because that's not a good relationship.
Yeah.
But that means there's a lot more social anxiety. Yes. And we know this. We know that there's increasing levels of social anxiety among people. And so, like, well, how do you deal with that? Well, you deal with it by putting yourselves in those situations of unpredictability more often. So you learn things like patience and forgiveness. Like, these are very important social skills. And the only way to learn them is through practice. And so, unfortunately, we have less practice at that because we're spending more time with these digital devices, which are taking the unpredictability of life away. It's getting harder for us to live with the fact of other people.
So that just made me think of something, though. So we, and you know, I'm kind of on the border of these two generations, maybe. But like, there are people who are 10, 20 years older than me who will just stipulate that they're of sound mind and are smart, but just seem like overwhelmed with technology. Like, they can barely answer a phone call on their cell phone. And if you ask them to use an app, they just are maybe know how to do it, maybe not, and just feel like overwhelmed by that. And there's certain younger generations who kind of roll their eyes at those people, right? Why can't you figure out how to use this? It's so easy. I mean, my 8-year-old, my 6-year-old knows how to do this. Why can't you? And I think that's true in many cases. But my point, though, is we don't often think of it the other way, is that you might have some 70-year-old who is, again, may not know much about technology, but they probably know much more about these social interactions that the younger generation has lost or have yet to develop. Should old people start like making fun of young people for that?
I don't think they should make fun of them, but you can appreciate, like, you put your finger on like, what is the source of so much of what we call generational difference, is the fact that many older people find the technology is what is so unpredictable. They've been dealing with other people for a long time. They find other people's responses relatively predictable. What they find is unpredictable is, like, what's going to happen if I push this button?
Yeah, or how do I watch the baseball game on TV? Oh, it's on a different cable? It's on that? Have it subscribed to something? What?
Right, and I've just figured out the rules to this, and now all the rules have changed so that every time I turn this device on, there's a different set of rules.
Yep.
Like, yeah, it's all discomfort with varying levels of predictability and unpredictability, and it's a matter of what you get used to.
But we all, like, know that, again, generally speaking, a 75-year-old is not going to be a whiz at technology, and a 25-year-old probably is. But we don't talk enough about the other way around, though.
We don't. But here's what's so interesting. Like, the workplace is changing so rapidly. We used to think, oh, like, younger generation, as long as you're in something that's tech-related, you're going to have job security. There's a lot of demand, right?
Coding, just learn how to code, and you'll be set for the next 50 years.
Yeah.
Well, guess what?
And this past year, we have reports now recently for, like, the most recent graduates from college, and one of the highest levels of unemployment is in computer science.
Yes.
Like, art history majors are twice as likely to get jobs. So unemployment rate in the most recent reports for art history majors was around 3%, but around 7% for computer science majors. Like, and for physics majors, it was even worse. I mean, huh. But philosophy majors, pretty good. I think it's 3.2% or something. Like, that's, like, hooray for that. But here's what's going on is there's all kinds of professions now where what seems to be really in demand is for people that have real skills in specialized fields. That is, they know how to use the technology, but they also know how to relate to people. And if you only know how to use the technology and can't relate to people, well, it's very likely AI is going to be able to do that job. No matter how successful AI becomes, we're always going to need people as interpreters or buffers or mediators with the technology and all the other people who are both sometimes coworkers and oftentimes clients. And so all these fields, whether it's marketing or accounting or education, all these fields are going to need people that know how to use the technology, also know how to interact with people. And so we're going to need the skills of both generations, both extremes of the generations.
We end each show by tackling an ethical dilemma. And Rick, here is my question for you, and it's related to much of what we've talked about on the show so far today. You are a manager at a company, and one of your employees works fully remote. Her performance is excellent, but she has confided in you that she feels isolated and disconnected from the rest of the team. You encourage her to come into the office occasionally to build relationships, but she resists, citing family obligations and a long commute. How would you balance respecting her personal circumstances with your responsibility to foster connection and belonging in the workplace?
The dilemma that you present there is something that we're actually finding now as we're getting a lot more data about what's going on with both remote work and hybrid work. And what we're finding generally is that many people who are doing remote work are very productive. That was a big concern when remote work first started.
Will they just be doing their laundry and all day long?
Yeah, and it turns out, like, for a lot of people doing remote work, they might even be more productive than if they were in the office.
Yeah, but there's not people stopping by and distracting them about the football game last night or whatever.
Right. The other thing is that they're often really satisfied. That is, they like the remote work and they don't want to change it. The other thing is that they're not nearly as engaged.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they feel disconnected from the team. They don't know the other team members. And it's really an unusual kind of workplace that is able to have both, have like high satisfaction with the remote work and also high engagement. There are some places that manage it. It's harder when you're hybrid. And I think you're describing a hybrid situation where you have one person that's remote. You have
on the same team, yes.
On the same team. And you have other people who are in the workplace.
Yes.
I mean, they're going to have different kinds of relationships. And I think what you do is you talk with that person and you find out, well, first of all, I think, like, if you can, I think it's good to bring people into the workplace in person. I think that engagement is that important. But if you've hired somebody and you've hired them with the expectation that they're going to be able to continue working remotely, and they have some kind of family situations, or they're so far away that it's really not feasible for them to come in, I think you have a responsibility to honor that. There might be some compromises that can be made where there's like 1 or 2 days a week that the person comes in. And there are other things that you can do on a regular basis, like team retreats and so forth, where you say, okay, this is mandatory. You don't have to come in every day. You don't have to come in once a week. But we're going to, like once a month, for example, we're going to bring everybody together and you have to participate in that. And I would say that there's I don't see any other way of bridging that gap.
Well, and that's what's important, though, right, is it doesn't make sense to say to this employee, we think it's important you come into work occasionally. So why don't you we'd expect you here every Tuesday, we'll just say. And then every Tuesday, she shows up and sits down at a desk and does the exact same work she's doing at home. And she walks away saying, well, I just spent 8 hours sitting at this desk and I had a 45-minute commute here and a 45-minute commute home. I could have easily done this same exact work sitting at home and not having to uproot my life in sort of these ways. I think what you're saying is that when you do have the expectation to bring someone like that into the workplace, whether it's once a week, once a month, or whatever the cadence is to make that day or those days different, right? So you have like a time to spend together as a group, talking through issues, brainstorming solutions, whatever, right? Because otherwise, yeah, the employees are going to say, I can just sit at this desk as easily as I can sit at the desk back at my house.
And you lose some of the kind of informal, the, you know, the meaning, if they're like a break room or common areas, or sort of, that you miss out on the kind of relationship building that happens there. Well, so be it. You still, that just means you have to be more intentional about the ways in which you bring your team together.
To go back to the first part of the show, I had mentioned that, you know, workplaces have changed a lot over the years, and you've been teaching in this space for a few decades now. Obviously, the pandemic was sort of the driver for a lot of these changes, and obviously advances in technology as well. Do you think that overall, in the grand scheme of work, that at least the opportunity to give people the option to work remotely has been a net positive? Or do you think it has just further harmed those work relationships that we just can probably not go and rebuild in any real way? Although you do see, I guess, at the same time, you do see some companies more and more having these return to work mandates in pretty big and important ways.
So I think it's been both, and I think it largely depends on the nature of the work, the kind of employees that one is seeking. Sometimes you might be a company that needs like highly specialized people, but you're located in an area where you just don't have enough of them there. And unless you're going to move to a very big city where you can find a certain concentration of those people, you're going to have to employ people that are remote, but they're all over the country. The technology that developed during the pandemic has made that possible in ways that wasn't really possible before.
But you look at Silicon Valley, right? And there's so many companies from Google to Apple to, you know, many, many others are all based in this small corner of the country. And I think I even read that when Walmart, which is based in Arkansas, was spinning up its e-commerce site and really trying to get a lot more money out of that side of the business, instead of doing that in Arkansas, they put that part of the business in Silicon Valley. To me, that all says that the place you're working does matter, right? Because you do have this cluster of people who are all, you know, not working for the same company, but doing sort of the same type of work in the same area that naturally attracts similar talent and similar, they just sort of build on top of each other. And I don't think it's, you know, if you said we're going to start a Silicon Valley in Tennessee, I'm sure the people in Tennessee would think that's great, but it's like incredibly hard to do. I mean, Silicon Valley, you know, the history of that goes back like 50, 60, 70 years now, right? I think, which and it's just interesting how you look at places like that sort of attract these people now for a few generations, that just shows me that a sense of place in work does really matter.
Yeah, and especially if you're a large company that is looking to develop, you're probably going to go into one of these places like Silicon Valley, San Francisco, Seattle, maybe Dallas.
Austin, yeah. Austin. Yeah, these kind of key tech hubs.
Yeah. Do you remember Gateway Computers was in South Dakota?
That's right. I had forgotten about that. Sioux Falls, South Dakota. They had the big boxes with cow. Looked like
yeah,
cows
and
on the outside.
I thought they were a great company, yeah. but they didn't last. I don't know what ever happened to them. But you don't see a lot of tech companies being located in there. But, you know, pretty good quality of life.
Yeah.
It's just not where tech people go.
And certainly more affordable.
Right. But a lot of times, if you're a smaller company and you need a team of, say, a dozen really highly specialized people that are going to work together, then they're going to be doing some individual work, but they have to come together and work as teams also. I mean, it is possible because of things like Microsoft Teams and Zoom and so forth to have really highly productive team meetings among people that live anywhere. And some of those companies are really successful in managing that kind of work environment. But if you are going to try to attract two or 300 people to do that, you probably want to locate in some area where that's where that kind of people go to mm-hmm. live.
As a reminder, the Ethical Life podcast is a production of Lee Enterprises. Please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and be sure to check out Rick's column about ethics. And it touches on many of the same issues we discussed on the show today. And that can be found on all Lee websites. For Rick Kite, I am Scott Rada. Thank you for listening.